Hi, my name is Lambro Christoulas, and welcome to the all-new Security and Perimeter Podcast, hosted by my dad, Athanasios Christoulas, a.k.a. Saki. We have built, back, a better podcast, a more sensitive podcast, a podcast that wants to show you how much it cares about the world, except for Afghanistan, and our alliance partners in NATO, like France. But other than that, and with the help of Dr. Jill Bynum, we will create a better podcast. So, without further delay, please enjoy the latest episode of
the Security Perimeter Podcast.
So, welcome back to a brand new episode of the Security Perimeter Podcast. While it's actually not that brand new, it was actually recorded about a month and a half ago. It stars retired Colonel Jamie Cade once again to the podcast. He had given us an episode about 2 or 3 years ago, his experiences in Afghanistan. And this talk that he gave is to my students in methodology. He was a special guest, an invited guest. He was actually in town in Mexico for something else, and it happened to coincide with Biden run for your life evacuation from Afghanistan. And having known that Jamie had served in Afghanistan in the middle of the 2000s, I think 2006 to 2008, as deputy commander of the Canadian deployment in Kandahar, I asked him if he would be willing to come to my class and give a talk about what it was like to serve in the military. A lot of the students were interested in what his life was like in the military, how his wife felt about him being in the military, stuff like that. Many of the students gave me some questions beforehand that Jamie asked for to help him set up the discussion. And yeah, he told us what it was like to live and have a life in the military. And then he spoke about the deployment in Afghanistan and what that was like. Well, he essentially explains from a Canadian point of view why the mission failed. And it's actually quite interesting to hear somebody discuss the whole Afghanistan thingy, someone who is actually on the ground, who knows what the hell they're talking about, as opposed to Biden and some other people, Blinken. I think someone like Jamie Cade has a lot more to tell us about what happened in Afghanistan, why the evacuation took place, why the mission failed, and of course, what it's like to live in the military and work in the military and have a life in the military. He talks about some other deployments that he had before he went to Afghanistan. So it's actually a pretty darn interesting discussion. Yeah, so without further ado, Jamie Cade talks about what it's like to be in the military, some of his previous deployments before Afghanistan, and then what it was like to be in Afghanistan and his opinion on why the whole mission failed. So, yeah, this is a good one, folks. So, just a quick warning before I turn it over to Jamie. This conference was done in public, which means that everybody was masked up. You know, but in spite of that, actually, the audio's pretty darn good. And with some of the software that, you know, I have on the mixer and stuff like that, I was able to clean it up a little bit better. But still, it's actually quite good, given the fact that everybody was masked.
Jamie was Deputy Commander of Canadian Forces in Afghanistan between 2006 and 2008 in Kandahar, which was probably the worst place to be in Afghanistan at that time, I suppose. It was a pretty nasty place. And Jamie's going to talk a little bit about his experiences while he was there. And the thing that I like about what Jamie wants to talk about is he doesn't want to get into the politics of this. He doesn't want to get into whether or not it was a right or wrong decision to go or to leave, or to whatever. He just really wants to tell the story from a soldier's perspective. And some of you send me questions, and I forward them to Jamie, and Jamie really liked those questions and comments a lot. And I think the way we're going to start this, the way we'll do this is we'll let Jamie tackle some of those issues that you guys sent me, starting with Daphne's, which is the first one, by the way. And once we get through the discussion that's going to take place, that first Jamie's going to speak, and then maybe you guys have some comments and questions and kind of do a back and forth between who's ever here in the room, then what we can do is then we can go to the Zoomlandia people and any kind of questions or comments they may have. Ines is here with us, who's gonna do the tech aspect of all of this. Ines, if you can sort of be watching the comments in Zoomlandia to kind of see, because it's going to be impossible to take all of them, but maybe to kind of get a synthesis of maybe the most significant ideas. So without further ado, let me present to you retired Colonel Jamie Kay, Canadian Armed Forces. Jamie, thank you so much for being here with us. This is such an honor for Tom and for me. And I'm just so happy to have you here. And I miss you. It's been a long time since we've seen each other. So I'm glad to see you again on a very personal level.
Thank you, Santi. I'm going to tackle this in about three parts. Number one is I'm going to group your very insightful and humanist questions that you sent me. And I really like that. Saki is absolutely correct. This is about people, right? It's not about soldiers. It's not about diplomats. It's not about the Taliban. It's about all of that because they're all people. And everyone has been affected by this in a different way. And the war goes on for so many people, even though Canada has left that war 10 years ago. And then I'm going to talk a little bit about the big elephant in the room in the Western media, at least, which is the Taliban victory in Afghanistan, as the media like to portray it. And then I just have some quick comments about where I think Afghanistan will go under the Taliban. So, starting with your questions, who am I? Well, I spent 37 years in the Canadian Army. I never had a real job until I retired in 2016. I went from high school straight into basic training and military college. I have served in West Germany. It was not Germany in those days. I was just a young lieutenant, and the Cold War was on, and Germany was still split between the Soviet Union bloc and NATO. I served for a year in Australia. That was great. I also was here in Mexico. My last 4 years, which were without doubt some of the best years of my career, I was the encargado de defensa de Canadá aquí en México, para México y América Latina. And so that was just an amazing experience. I also spent a lot of time in operations, both on the staff side of things, so planning operations, supporting operations, outside and inside Canada, and I deployed myself. Domestically, my regiment under my command fought forest fires in British Columbia. I served as a company commander in the NATO peacekeeping mission in Bosnia. And as Saki said, I spent close to a year in Afghanistan as the deputy commander of all Canadian forces there. My family history, I do come from a military family. My grandfather and I served in the same regiment as my grandfather and my father. My grandfather fought in the First World War. My father and one of his brothers fought in the Second World War. And that's not the reason I decided to join the Army, but when I did decide to join the Army, it was just natural I'd go into that. My kids have gone entirely different paths, and I'm very proud of that. My wife would have loved if they had joined the Army and the regiment, but they're doing very, very well in their own careers. My wife Beth and I, we met in Victoria. She was going to the University of Victoria, and I was going to a place that is now closed, Royal Roads Military College. We were married the day after I graduated. So she is the true sense of what we call in the Canadian military an army spouse. She spent her life having to follow me around because I was moved all over the country of Canada and overseas on a regular basis. And she had to keep things together on the home front quite often in difficult circumstances. So moving to questions about Afghanistan, Canada, for a variety of reasons, ended up when they said that they would come back to Afghanistan and when it transitioned from a U.S.-led mission to a NATO mission, they got positioned, they were given the responsibility for Kandahar province, which is in the south of Afghanistan, and it borders on Pakistan, which is very, very important. Kandahar was, if it wasn't the toughest turf to have, it was certainly way up there. It was the birthplace of the Taliban. Mullah Omar, who was the spiritual leader of the Taliban, was born in a village right beside where one of the main Canadian strong points was built. So the Taliban were at home in Kandahar province and had a lot of indigenous support, for lack of a better word. And that border with Pakistan, well, that was a safe haven for the Taliban. And it's not really a secret now, but the Pakistani military intelligence assisted the Taliban quite a bit. So where we were located was rather tough. Kandahar City, the capital of Kandahar, is strategically very, very important in Afghanistan because it has been said time and time again by numerous countries that have been involved through the centuries that he or she who controls Kandahar City controls the access to Kabul, the capital. So strategically, it was very important that we did not lose Kandahar City to the Taliban. I was in the Canadian forces, support forces and tactical headquarters were located in a place called Kandahar Airfield. If you hear me say CAF, it's a bad habit. It stands for Kandahar Airfield. It was about half-hour drive outside of Kandahar City, and it was built around the Kandahar City Airport. That place was when I was there, it was 35,000 people in Kandahar Airfield. It was a small fortress. Actually, it was a large fortress. It had militaries from around the world participating. It had civilians, diplomats, aid workers. It was massive. It was noisy. It was dusty. And it also had the added benefit that it got rocketed pretty much every night. Very rudimentary. It wasn't real serious stuff. It was timed. The Taliban would make makeshift rockets and put them on rudimentary timers, like water drip timers and that sort of stuff, and it would land somewhere. Very rarely did it ever do any damage or harm, but it was still a nuisance. Kandahar province. Kandahar city, the capital, was relatively modern. It's a big relative. It had electricity. It had paved roads. It had commerce, but it was not a very prosperous city. The province itself, and this is going to sound pejorative, it's going to sound aggressive, but it was not far off the Stone Age. It was very, very undeveloped, and there was no running water. Access to clean well water was difficult. It was agricultural in nature. And it was very, very, very conservative. The other problem with Kandahar province was 85% illiteracy rate. 85% of the population could not read or write. And that made them very, very vulnerable to influence. Because you would have the wandering mullahs telling you, mullah is a wise man, educated in the Quran, saying things that the Quran said that doesn't exist in the Quran, and they had no opportunity to verify that themselves. It also made it very hard to communicate with them. We had to communicate through pictograms, pictures. So things like stay away from the convoy, keep away from it. You had to have little pictures that demonstrated don't bring your vehicle within a certain distance. Why did they have to stay away? Because suicide bombers attacked their convoys all the time. And it was always be on the lookout for a white Toyota Corolla. It's a suicide bomber. Every single car in Kandahar is a white Toyota Corolla. The environment, two, was suicide bombers, improvised explosive devices set all the time, ambushes, and terrorism. Taliban did some horrific things to their people, absolutely horrific. So that was the environment. The team we had, we had Canadian combat troops there, we had Canadian Air Force. Obviously, as the deputy commander, my commander and I, we had a headquarters, and our headquarters was pieced together from people right across Canada, from all services, Army, Navy, Air Force. So it was a challenge to bring these folks together into a tight, cohesive team, but I got to tell you, our training was excellent. They gave us a lot of time to train. We studied Afghan history. We studied the culture. We were put through a lot of drills, an awful lot of drills, which thank God we were, because we absolutely everything we were tested on, we experienced it in real life. We also received a lot of conditioning, emotional conditioning, to recognize the signs of PTSD, post-traumatic stress syndrome, in others and in yourself, and mental exercises you can do to protect yourself more against the mental issues you may develop experiencing that sort of stress. My commander, Dennis Thompson, an exceptional guy. We were close. We became very close friends in training, and we remained so. He was always forward. He was outside this fortress, and he was out with the Canadian troops. I, unfortunately, was always stuck in this horrible place, and I dealt with Ottawa. And any mission anywhere in the world, you have two enemies. You have two problems to deal with. You have, if it's a peacekeeping mission, there's the former warring factions. In Afghanistan, it was the Taliban. But common to all of those scenarios is you have to deal with your national capital. And because of the politics involved, they have an insatiable thirst for knowledge. And so it was my job to keep our senior generals and our politicians calm during sometimes tough times. The stress, I'll be honest with you, was incredible. The way I likened it is, I don't know if you remember, you're all very young compared to me, but you got the old wind-up alarm clocks where it didn't run on batteries, you wound it. So that was all of us, except that spring never got unwound. It was like you were always twisting it. So that spring was always tight in your body because day and night there was always something coming in that you had to deal with. But it wasn't until we got out of theater, and it took about 2 or 3 weeks for the spring to unwind. And consequently, you only slept about 3 to 4 hours a night because you just wake up in the middle of the night. So not worrying, but working something through. How do we fix this? How is this going to go? Now, I'm not saying I regret a moment of this. We were part of a great team, and it was a fascinating experience. It was life-changing. It was, I wouldn't trade it for anything. Someone asked if I was ever homesick. Just too busy, just way too busy. Even though Kandahar Airfield was a really boring place on a day-to-day basis, like walking or whatever, there was never time to be bored. There was never time to be homesick. The only time I was homesick was Christmas Day. Because it was the first time I ever missed Christmas, but it wasn't too bad. I was able to call home regularly. By virtue of my position, I had a pretty reasonable room, and I had to have a phone because the operations center had to get a hold of me fast a lot of times. But I called home regularly, and that is actually a Canadian Forces policy to give all ranks ready access to internet and telephones, because keeping the home front calm and happy and dealing with family issues prevents having to send soldiers home because the family problem has gotten out of control. So that's why we have that policy. Beth and my kids, Jenny and Dave, somebody asked, well, you know, how is the stress for them? The stress was always at the back of their mind, but their coping mechanism, and Beth and I have talked about this a lot over the years, was very, very intelligent. Beth just didn't think about what could happen to me. But it was just not going to think about that. There's no point. It's not going to take you anywhere. And so both Beth and the kids, and they were both in university at the time, they just put it to the back of their heads, and yeah, and it was a great coping mechanism. Having to call home to deal with family problems, well, once I had to call my daughter because there's a few issues going on, and she was getting kind of rough with my wife, so not physically or anything like that. It was just a natural family thing, but yeah, I had to call home and say, don't make me come home, because you'll regret it. Okay, so what did we try to achieve? The military in Afghanistan, like in any peacekeeping mission, like any coalition mission, the military was there to buy time. Initially, when the military went into Afghanistan, so there was 9/11, and Al-Qaeda was based and well-established in Afghanistan. And they were developing biological labs and chemical labs, so there was more to come. So Afghanistan was invaded to destroy Al-Qaeda and their ability to operate out of Afghanistan. There, the military was used as a very, surgical is probably not the right word. But then countries involved with it felt a moral obligation to try and rebuild Afghanistan. And also it's logical, because if you just go in and boom and then leave, well, then Al-Qaeda will come back. So the idea was, let's build a prosperous Afghanistan with good governance. And so that was what the aim was. And the military was just there to buy time. And that meant combat operations, make no mistake about it. But the idea wasn't to absolutely eradicate the Taliban. It was to build up a democratically elected government and build an economy in Afghanistan. Because there's nothing in Afghanistan. So the main effort was not military, although it was always on the front page of the newspapers. It was economic development. It was building the mechanisms of good governance. And it was trying to bring political stability to the country so that it could get up on its feet. Now here's something that some people may find offensive. In the Islamic calendar, 2021, today is 2021 in our calendar. In the Islamic calendar, it is 1443. In the Western world in 1443, that was the medieval age. In a lot of parts of Afghanistan, they are not that far off. There is no technology. There's no machinery. Everything is done by hand. The ability to advance an economy and the ability to bring in ideas of fair and a fair government and democratic government, it is very, very challenging when a country is so poor and technologically hamstrung, I guess. There is no government, this is my opinion, there is no government or governments in Afghanistan. There is only tribalism. Even those elected were always part of a tribe, and their power base was coming from their tribe and their tribal connections. And the Taliban is all about tribal alliances. There is hardcore Taliban. I'll talk to that just in a moment. So that's a challenge with good governance. Throw on top of that, there are no railways in Afghanistan. There are very few paved roads, highways, that is, and there's very few airfields. They have no infrastructure, significant infrastructure. The majority of their cash right now is coming from growing poppy. They are the largest source of heroin to Western Europe, well, Europe, period. And so some countries had a policy of eradicating poppy fields. Canada did not. Canada, what we were trying to do is convince poppy farmers to grow wheat. We were giving them wheat seed because wheat was very expensive and they could make a lot of money off of it. And the problem with eradicating a poppy field is, by the time you know it's a poppy field and you eradicate it, the farmer that grew it has no time to grow any other crops before winter comes. So the Taliban come along and hire the farmer and his sons to dig in bombs on our roads, so put in improvised explosive devices. And so, of course, we had to stop that. And so instead of killing people that were hardcore Taliban, we were just killing farmers that were just trying to find a way to feed their family. That's not across the board the situation, but that is definitely was a problem with us, and we really put our heads around that when it was tough. We were also creating jobs, and we were building schools. We were building wells or rebuilding wells and digging them so the villages would have access to water. Canada had a very detailed, well-planned-out economic development plan, and it was well-funded. We sunk billions into Afghanistan, both in military assistance and in economic assistance and in helping them build the mechanisms of good governance. So this wasn't a case where we didn't put our effort in. Women. I had a real hard time with the way that the Afghans treated women. Kabul was different. Kabul, a lot of women were going to universities, schools. One of the Afghan National Army generals that I work with quite regularly, one of his daughters was a doctor, another was an economist. That was a different kettle of fish. In the north, they were much more progressive in their viewpoints. In the south, women were just a means of having and raising children. They were a commodity. And things like the burqa, burqa is very, very cruel. I actually put one on to see what it was like because you could buy them in the market inside Kandahar Airfield. And very, very hot, and it limits your vision. So you're very, very vulnerable. It is not a religious, the burqa is not religious dress. It is a cultural thing. It is not a religious thing. So that was not something that sat well with us. We sent women to school in Kandahar City. We improved their schools. We gave the funding so that the girls could go to school. And Taliban and motorcycles would throw acid in their face just so that they would disfigure the girl and therefore be able to do less work for the family. That's the sort of terrorism that we would see. We had our two mistakes, though, and this is a challenge, was pushing democracy. And Canada, one of its number one foreign policy platforms is promoting women's rights and protection of women and children. And that is absolutely 100% correct, both of those. But it is not a one-size-fits-all foreign policy. It has to be adjusted to the cultural and economic realities of the country. And the problem with pushing women's rights in a place like Kandahar, outside of Kandahar City, was they barely feed their children. So that's really not high up, and it makes them suspicious of the West. And as far as democracy goes, 87% illiteracy rate. How do you get a responsible democracy out of that? But then, as a Western country, you can't go and say, well, we're going to promote a benevolent dictatorship. That may be the right solution, but it's not acceptable with Canadians. So it was tough. We did a great job with the Afghan National Army and the Afghan National Police. Canadian soldiers trained them and lived with them and went to battle with them. We loved our interpreters. Our Afghan interpreters, without them, we could not have done anything because Pashtun is a very difficult language, as is Farsi. And it is our national shame that we did not get all our interpreters and our families out of Afghanistan. It is a big issue in Canada right now. We left 10 years ago, and our government just dragged its feet. And it's terrible we didn't get everyone out. The people in the Taliban, Afghans hate the Taliban, absolutely despise the Taliban. They hate their government worse. Their government just exploits them, steals from them, does not deliver. So they're sitting there going, oh man, it's like a bad election. Who do you go for? The government's just too corrupt. Somebody asked me what my best day was. My best day was, there's a place called the Dalit Dam. It was in the Argandab Valley up in the mountains. It was an irrigation dam that the Russians, the Soviets, had built. And the Argandab Valley is very fertile if there's regular water supply. Pomegranates, raisins. It's actually really quite beautiful in the summertime. That dam had silted up because of years of neglect. And the Canadian government announced and got the money to rehabilitate that irrigation dam. That was tough getting that sort of money. It was $15 million. Whether or not we were successful, I don't know. In my last years, I was down here, and I was really not interested in what was going on there. The day, someone asked the day if I could live it over again, my words, not theirs. It was the day Corporal Greenfield was killed. It was our tactical standard operating procedure that if we were going in on an operation into a hot spot, you always took, you did not use the same way out that you used in, because those in employing the Taliban would plant improvised explosive devices in the roads. So the commander and I are in the room being briefed by the commanding officer that was running this operation, and we call it the scheme of maneuver. Had them, they were going into a very, it was a rat's nest, but they were going to leave the same way. And I'm sitting there going, thinking to myself, why? Like, that's just fundamentally wrong. You can't do that. But I looked at my commander, and he must have been distracted or something, but I was expecting him to say something. And so I thought, well, maybe him and the lower commander have had a conversation on this. Not my place to say. I should have said something, because Corporal Greenfield hit an IED on the way out and was killed. That wasn't great. But, you know, that was the environment, right? And people make mistakes. You're talking about human beings. Every single person involved in Afghanistan were human beings. All right, so now I'm going to move to President Biden's statement. I'm so surprised why the government forces collapsed so quickly. Afghan government.
Jim, there was one question. What was your best day? What was the day that you?
It was the Taliban being announced.
Okay,
that's as good as it got. So. Actually, my best day was there was no crisis. So yeah. One day. Anyways, so President Biden said they collapsed so quickly, and the Afghan National Army was very, very well trained. Why did they collapse? It did not surprise me that they collapsed so quickly, and here's why. So I'm totally got it. Okay. All right. These are people who support the Afghan government. These are hardcore Taliban. And then the rest of the population, the vast, vast majority is there. These folks are going to stand by the government no matter what, because they know if the Taliban win, pardon the crudeness, but the track record is there, they'll be hanging from tank barrels. They have everything to lose. If the West didn't get them out, then they're in hiding right now or they're dead. The Taliban, there is no way our public outreach programs could reach these people. They are hardcore. They've been indoctrinated in the religious schools the frontier area of Pakistan. So from our military point of view, it was kill or capture. It was the only thing we could do with them. But these are two minorities. This is the majority of Afghans, and they're all tribal. And they can go that way, or they can go that way. And the challenge is getting them to move. Now, what gets them to move to one side or the other is the history of this country. It has been nothing but conflict. Afghanistan has had a very short period where there hasn't been conflict of some sort. So it is survival. My analogy, and it's not meant to be insulting to Afghans, but I spent a lot of time on the Canadian prairie provinces, and there's a lot of coyotes on the prairies. You see them all the time. And you'll see a coyote running across the prairie and suddenly stop, stick its nose up, and sniff the air. Because the coyote is trying to figure out what's coming next and where to go, either where it'll be safe or where the coyote will find a meal. That sniff in the air is predicting the future. The tribes are coyotes, and they go with who they think is going to win. How do you know that they've moved to the other side? You don't know. That was the challenge of Afghanistan. One day a tribe is supporting you. Next day, the Taliban are launching a surprise attack from within those tribal regions because the tribes moved over. So it was no surprise to me and to an awful lot of my friends that the government forces collapsed so quickly. They didn't really collapse. It's just the soldiers that belong to the various tribes, their tribal leaders, I'm guessing, said, you know what, we're cutting a deal with the Taliban. because, you know what, we got to live with the Taliban, so we're best to get in on the ground floor right now. That's why I believe everything collapsed so quickly. Afghanistan is not a nation. Mexico is a nation. Canada is a nation. Afghanistan is a country of tribes. Therefore, it is very, very difficult to bring them together. So who lost Afghanistan is one the Western media is loving to throw up. In Canada, we're saying, did we lose it? We pulled out too soon. Everyone's blaming the Americans for pulling out. My personal opinion, tribal, fractured, always fractured in unity, and corruption is endemic no matter who's in charge. The world came in and tried to help Afghanistan rebuild, and they did so for an awful long time. Many, many countries spent blood and treasure to give them the opportunity, and the elected governments just continued in their old ways. To me, the Afghans lost Afghanistan to the Taliban. Maybe that's too simplistic, but was it worth it for Canada? This is a question a lot of my friends are dealing with right now. I have a lot of friends who have post-traumatic stress from their time in Afghanistan, including the best man at my wedding. I've got friends that are, like myself, just fine. We came through it unscathed. But the big discussion right now is, holy cow, we lost 158 soldiers killed. 4 to 5 to 6 times more were either physically wounded or mentally wounded. A lot of blood and treasure, as I said, was it all worth it just to see it lost to the Taliban? The way I view it is I believe it was all worth it, but I'm selfishly looking at my country. My country had gone through a long period of being very naive. And so we had done our peacekeeping missions and we were starting to rest on our peacekeeping laurels. But the fact is, if you want to be a world player and you want to have a voice at world tables, it's not enough to just give money. You actually have to get involved. And Afghanistan, Canadians, the majority of Canadians were not supportive of the mission. And it was a split. It was even worse if you're talking about French-speaking Canada to English-speaking Canada. English-speaking was just over 50%. French-speaking never got better than 34% in favor of the effort in Afghanistan. So it was tough back home, but the support for the military was huge. And suddenly Canadians became flag wavers. You started to see Canadians waving flags. They named highways after veterans. There was this awakening that I think did a lot of good for my country. I wish that awakening could have been done differently, but you got to play the pitch that's thrown you. Will the Taliban succeed is my last thing, and then I'll turn it over to everyone else. I don't think so. They're running a good PR thing right now. They're saying, no, we've learned we're going to be different with women. Yet their actions, naming their cabinets now, are suggesting, no, they're not actually going to honor that statement. The senior positions are going to some pretty nasty people that we were very familiar with. But also, it's still a tribal-based society. And the North, the majority of Afghans are Pashtun, and they are mainly in the South. And the Taliban are Pashtun. In the North, you've got different tribes, or ethnic backgrounds, sorry. And eventually, they've been beat right now, but they'll start to fight again. I don't think the Taliban are that sophisticated to keep the country moving forward, to get the country moving forward. But I really hope I'm wrong, because I really don't care who rules Afghanistan. I would just like to see that country see some peace and let people get on with things that we take for granted. So I've been frank and honest in my comments, and I do hope I haven't offended anyone, because it definitely was not my intention. But I do believe that when you're talking about people, you can't be political in your comments. You got to talk like a human. And I've now way too much. I'm really interested in your views. Push back. if challenge me on why I think a certain way or why I said something. Because a dialogue is just, this is a fascinating time for this country, Afghanistan being this country. You know, where do they go? Chinese are coming in and the Russians are talking about helping out. Good luck to them. But they need to read history and pay attention to the history that we read and pretty much ignored.
Okay, well, I think we'll open it up to comments or questions or queries from you guys. Sorry, from you guys. Yeah, Claudio, go ahead.
Do you think it was the right move to leave, or should they, should NATO have stayed?
Okay.
Are you talking about the August evacuation?
Yeah, like right now, yeah. Or like Canada, should they have gone back, no?
Yeah, okay, so Canada leaving, and Canada going back, and the U.S. leaving. All three excellent questions. Canada left. That was another really difficult thing during our tour, because there was a national election when we were in Afghanistan, and we had just taken on more responsibility. And it was a conservative government, and the liberal opposition were ramping up to attack the conservative government on being in Afghanistan. And just as the election was called, the prime minister of the day turned around and said, at the end of this, I think we'd signed on for 4 years or 3 years, at the end of this, Canada's coming home. We're no longer participating. So international strategically, that was a really, really horrible thing to do. From domestic political strategy, it was pure genius, because the opposition party in the election was in complete disarray, because that was their election platform, and suddenly it was gone. So that's why we came home. It wasn't because we had done our job. And so then having to work with our allies, we were going, well, I thought you guys were in it for the long haul. So that caused a lot of friction, an awful lot of friction. The Americans pulling out, that's a tough one. So I got a very, very good buddy. He was commander of Canadian forces in Afghanistan. We're very close friends. We're almost brothers. And he then went back with the Americans in the American headquarters as an exchange general. He was also a planner in American Central Command, CENTCOM, which was responsible for the Afghan theater. And he was arguing, Jamie, we're getting there. We're getting there. The Afghan National Army, they have come so far since you were there. And I'm going, Dean, it's always going to be a struggle. It's just, we did our best. It's time to go. I think it was the right thing to pull out, because we were not going to win. All we could do was just continue to prop up a government that wasn't going to change. And sorry, I said win. That's the wrong word. We were never going to get the democratically elected governments to a point where they could start to function responsibly. And so just ethically, I had a real issue with continuing to support people that were playing us for fools, but were exploiting their people. Does that answer your question?
Yeah, but Jamie, can I push you on that?
Sure,
you
know, please do.
Remember you said you drew that graph up there where the wind blows, so to speak,
yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
If NATO would have been there, wouldn't have the wind blown in the direction of NATO, so to speak?
Okay, really, really good point. Some of the more complications about our operations. In Kandahar and the South as a whole, because they didn't know who Canadians were when they arrived, and they didn't know what a maple leaf meant. They didn't know any of the flags. They knew the American flag because of propaganda. So NATO was seen by a lot of people as invaders. And the one thing Afghans don't like is foreigners in their country because of their national history. All right, and I'm very familiar with Mexico's history. I've studied it a lot myself, so I know there's a lot of empathy. Having, you know, being occupied by foreigners is just, it doesn't sit well with anyone. Afghanistan just has a really bad history of this. They don't like foreigners. They don't like occupying forces. It was okay in the beginning because we got rid of the Taliban, but then the Taliban came back and started an insurgency. And the Taliban were smart. They orchestrated a lot of horrible things. I remember one day my commander got a phone call from the governor of Kandahar province saying, what in the hell have you done? And Dennis is going, what are you talking about, Governor? And he said, the hospital in Kandahar is filled full of casualties from a wedding party. An American Special Forces Patrol had gone up into an area, hadn't talked to us, it was our turf, but Special Forces operate differently. And the Taliban had set up an ambush, but it was very, very clever. The ambush was set up so that there was a wedding going on in a compound. And so the patrol didn't know that. And next thing you know, the Taliban start opening up on them, and then there is just, so there's a big gunfight, and the rounds are going through the wall, because they're all walled communities, and the bride's in the hospital. That didn't go down well with the locals. And so the longer NATO stayed, I mean, we had restrictions put in on us because airstrike would go bad, and next thing you know, how airstrikes were brought in were restricted. Sometimes it was a logical thing to do. Sometimes it was just a restriction that wasn't going to change anything. So the longer NATO stayed, the less and less the people were happy with the foreigners, and more the Taliban cranked up the propaganda machine. So I don't think, even though they saw that their Afghan National Army, they're very proud of it, and the Afghan National Army was doing more and more, police were hopeless, but the army was doing more. It was still, I mean, NATO was there for so long that my read is the local population was just going, this is no better. That's my personal opinion. If Dean was here right now, oh, he'd be yelling at me.
Kali?
Yeah.
That's great.
Anybody else?
I have a question.
Well, there's Daphne.
Yeah. So I assume you work like with other countries.
Yes.
Did you ever have any conflict like working together?
Yes. Excellent.
Oh, yeah, the Americans.
Excellent question. There's a quote that gets kicked around all the time, something along the lines of, you know, the only thing I hate more than the Taliban are the allies I have to work with. Every country's got a different viewpoint. You know, I said the Brits and the Americans, well, maybe I didn't name them, they would bulldoze and burn bobby fields. We're going, no, we will not touch that. So they would get really irritated with us because we would not destroy the bobby fields in our area. You've got, they call them national caveats. Every nation that goes together, whether it be with NATO, whether it be with the United Nations, or just a coalition, they all have their own national laws. And in Canada, Canadian national law applies to Canadians no matter where you are in the world. So if I do something here in Mexico that is against the law in Canada, I will be tried for it in Canada. And that applies to soldiers as well. And then there are, so things like in the U.S., you can use deadly force to protect property. Somebody breaks into your house to steal your TV set, you can actually, it's like they're coming at you, you can actually use deadly force to protect your property. In Canada, you cannot. You can only use deadly force to protect your proportional force to protect your own life. So, you know, that was always a friction point with us. Americans would say, well, we want you to, anyone goes near that point, we want you to, you know, bomb them, you know, whatever. It had to be designated mission essential equipment. So, yes, if somebody's going to blow up an ammunition dump, yeah, we're going to use deadly force to protect it, but that's designated equipment. There's an example of a caveat where you get friction points. Personalities. Every nation is different. The Brits have a certain personality, and Canada's got a long history being a Commonwealth country with the UK, and sometimes it's a good history, and sometimes it's not so great history. And you know, we've been on missions where we've been like that with each other. The Americans are always the elephant in the room. They have all the power. They always do all the heavy lifting, and so consequently, some of them can be, you know, a bit pushy. And it's okay, wait a minute, we're not bringing as much as you to the table, but we're still doing what we can do. And by the way, we still have brains, and we still have viewpoints. and our strength of sharing our viewpoints and finding common ground, not just doing it your way. So there is, Bulgarians were responsible for security of the Kandahar airfield that I called the fortress. I would go for a morning run early every morning and run around, and you know, they drove me nuts because they spent more time looking at me, and it's, hey, you should be looking at the other side where the bad people are. So you not only get different viewpoints, you get varying degrees of competency. And the problem is the more advanced, capable nations get called out for all the missions, whether it be UN or otherwise, and you get a bit of fatigue. So in the UN, you get a lot of missions that are desperately short soldiers. So there are some countries in the world that use UN peacekeeping missions to fund their defense department. So they put in just a ton of soldiers, and because the UN pays a per diem. We give our per diem to the soldier. Some countries put it in the defense department. So they're doing a lot, but they're not very capable soldiers. And that is, I tell you, Bosnia, that was a real problem. That at times that was a real problem, where the people that you're relying upon you next to you were absolutely completely incompetent and doing stuff that was really uncool, really uncool. Sorry, a long-winded way of saying, yes, working with allies is horrible, but working without allies is worse. Canada's strategic military policy is we will always work with allies. We know that we are too small to go it alone, so we will always. So consequently, the U.S., Britain, New Zealand, Australia, we all train, we all develop our doctrine very closely together, where we agree on terminology, all these things. Because if NATO, the biggest thing NATO does is they have common terminology for everything. So it doesn't matter what country you come from, this thing in a tactical plan means the same thing to everybody. That's how important allies are. Not allies, partners. Partners. Because allies implies a defense, and the only defense agreement Canada has is NATO and North American Aerospace Defense Treaty with the U.S.
Anybody else? Dennis?
Yes, thank you. Keeping in mind the conditions that you just mentioned that you're engaged in, how do you keep the spirits up of the men and women that are fighting that you're taking command of? How do you keep them engaged in the sense that the war doesn't become unbearable for them?
Yeah. It's actually easier than you think. First of all, we're a volunteer military. There is no conscription. Consequently, everyone is there of their own free will. And the majority of folks, when you sign up to go in uniform, whether it be the Navy or the Air Force or the Army, you don't want to spend your entire career sitting in bases in Canada. You want to get out and see the world. So when, as perverse, I guess is the right word, as it may seem, you get a conflict, that's what they all joined up. They joined up to go serve their country and make a difference in the world. So getting volunteers never hurt at all for people in uniform to deploy. They all want to go. Plus the money is good. The money is really good. And that never hurts. While you're there, the whole connecting people to family, so internet, phone calls, the ability, no matter where we've got them, the ability to have at least a call a week with their loved ones, that is really, really good for morale. When things are getting tough, really tough, and this transcends every military in the world, black humor, laughter just takes a whole pile of pressure, and it's dark humor, generally speaking, because it's just horrible stuff is happening. But sometimes, in amongst these horrible things, within that horrible thing that just happened, there's something just really weird that occurred. And it gets everyone laughing. Or somebody did a really goofy thing, and you tease them about it, and you get a big laugh. It's a long story, I can't tell it here, but I actually approved a mission that brought in a jet fighter from the USS Ronald Reagan aircraft carrier in the Indian Ocean into Kandahar province to drop a missile onto what turned out to be a rock crusher in a core. We were getting rocket attacks, and imagery intelligence picked up a tube with a tarp over it, but it was in a place we couldn't go. It was too dangerous to go. Anyways, long story short, a lot of analysis. I got teased for the rest of the tour, and I had 2 months to go. The nicknames, I was the rock crusher, you name it. At one point, the commander, and there would always be these jokes come up, every night there's brief, an upbeat brief, and there would always be these jokes that would come up, referring to rocks of some sort. So finally, the commander, he's in camp, and he goes, all right, stop, enough, leave the death alone. Deputy was sort of nicknamed death. He goes, leave him alone. Let him start with a clean slate. And,
get it, slate.
But I could have killed him because finally he's going to make them stop teasing me. But no, he's teasing me.
Did you get the slate part? Or did it take a couple? Oh, okay. You did get the slate part, right?
Oh, yeah. No, I thought the joke and it was a rumor erupting in the last. First of all, everyone's going, oh, the commander's really upset. And Dennis never got upset. But the commander was upset, oh boy, and then it's, let him start with the clean
slate. Slate means rock in Dennis? Okay, in English? Sorry, excuse me. They may not know.
No, I appreciate that.
Do you want to follow up on? Because I think I have a bit of a follow up.
No, that's okay. Thank
you. What about guys and gals that kind of crack under the pressure? It's their first deployment, their first mission, right?
Yeah.
And they realize that I can't do this.
Yeah. Well, I sent them home.
They gotta go home, right?
Yes, absolutely. And I was just gonna correct myself. The worst thing you can do if somebody's starting to crack is pull them out of the whole game without letting them, give them a chance to calm down. In the Second World War, they called it battle stress then. In the Second World War, everyone would eventually succumb to battle stress. One of the best episodes of Band of Brothers, the HBO series Band of Brothers, is the episode where the beloved platoon commander, he breaks. He succumbs to PTSD. You bring him back, you give him counseling. Peer counseling is the best counseling. Having them go see a doctor or shrink it's the meaning. It's better that peers, other soldiers who have been trained in how to talk through these sorts of things, talk to them. But if they're not having any success, they go to see the medical professional that is always on a mission, and then that professional will make an assessment on whether or not they have to return home. It's not normally, though, people that don't normally break the first go. It is our biggest cases of, and worst cases of post-traumatic stress, were the second tour guys, the third tour guys and girls. Bosnia was actually, the UN mission in Bosnia was actually the worst, absolutely the worst, because back then we didn't really recognize this, and consequently we just saw them as malingerers. A malingerer is somebody who's trying to get out of carrying their share of the load, and we just saw them using this mental problem as a way of getting out of work. And eventually we realized, no, it is, they were subjective. The UN mission, as opposed to the NATO mission, peacekeeping mission in Bosnia, was just terrible for the troops that had to participate in it. They had to stand by and watch atrocities be committed, and they weren't allowed to do anything about it. The folks that buckled under that, a lot came home and were fine, but then they went off to Afghanistan, or they went off to Ethiopia, Eritrea, and that sort of builds up. My buddy, who was best man at my wedding, I remember he was going back, he had been to, we had served in Bosnia together, but that wasn't a tough tour. He served in Kosovo, that was a tense occasion, but it wasn't too bad. He was on the first mission to Afghanistan, and then I remember seeing him in Canada, and, hey Steve, how's it going, buddy? And he goes, yeah, I'm going back to Afghanistan. And I said to him, I said, Steve, be very, very careful about drawing from the well too many times. You can't keep going back. And sure enough, he went back, And when he came home, it took 2 years for it to manifest itself. But it manifested itself in severe alcoholism, severe gambling addiction. His marriage just crumbled, as you would expect. A bad marriage to begin with, but and he hit rock bottom. Now, he's dry. He's got counseling. He's got a new wife. He's got a kid. He's beat the gambling. He still smokes, chain smokes. He just can't. He can't deal with that. But he's never going to be right. Right. That is the wrong expression. He's never going to be 100%. And it's those folks that are the toughest to assist. And then the ones with grievous injuries, too. I've got another friend lost both legs, sat down on an improvised explosive device, and blew both his legs off. And he just had a hellish time. He's good, but boy, did a rough one.
Some of them get addicted to the tools. They need to go back and back for some reason.
Yeah, and that is actively discouraged in the Canadian Army or Canadian forces. However, sometimes there is no choice. Afghanistan, the demand just started getting bigger and bigger, and so just more and more people were going over a second, third, fourth time. Not too many people went over four times.
Fourth.
Yeah, that's a hell of a lot.
Really pushing.
And in different places. I was not outside the wire, as we called it, very often, so I was not subjected to direct danger very often. There were troops there, they were in some of the outposts they were in, they were attacked daily. Nightly. Every night they were attacked. Those folks, I talked to them in the outposts.
One tour.
Yeah, just a one tour. Yep.
Just one tour, right? They just do one tour. You can't send them back a second time.
Yeah, but sometimes you have to. Now, it's volunteer. Wrong. You can be told you're going on a mission, but you have to go see a social worker or a padre, a chaplain, your choice. You have to be approved by your commanding officer. So at any of those steps that you have to go through, you could turn around at one point and say, you know what, I'm having a lot of family problems. I'm not sure those family problems will go away if I deploy. Well, automatically, you're not going over. So you can get out of doing another tour. But it's better if your leadership pays attention to how many tours you have and don't let you go on too many tours.
Can something be said from all of these efforts that the Allied forces made in Afghanistan? Or is it all just lost time?
Good question. Really good question. Well, we certainly did our best, and that sounds like kind of a weak answer, but we built schools. We had economic development programs. We got a lot of women educated in Kabul. We as in the coalition and allied efforts. We got a lot of people educated. We introduced people to different ways of thinking about the way they treat women, for example. So I'm running that question through my head because right now it's too easy to turn around and say, yeah, but you lost. So the Afghan people are probably going to go back to the way it was. Well, the Taliban are saying that, no, we learned something from our experience too, and we realize that we can't be that hardcore. So we've got to come a bit to your way. We're a bit skeptical on that. I feel we did make a difference. Or we tried to make a difference. We really, really tried. Economic development. If you don't have a secure area, you can't go in and build something. So Dala Dam had to be secure. And it's the ink spot theory. And I'm not dodging your question or trying to lead you down a rabbit hole. I'll come back to it. Ink spot theory in combating insurgency is the whole area is unsafe. So you have to establish secure areas. And you hold them and make them secure so that the real people that fix the country or help the country get on its feet. Because if the country's not going to get up on its feet, then you can't get it up on its feet, like we've seen in Afghanistan. And so the economic development occurs here and the good governance. starts to be built up here. So you start to have a success. And then that negates the need. So when this area starts to settle down and realize that, you know what, if we're stable, we don't need military forces. So then the military force goes and sets up secure areas, and eventually they call it the ink spot theory of counterinsurgency, because like a drop of ink on a white shirt, it bleeds. All right? So success will beget success. That's what we're trying to do. I talked a lot about good governance and why we just couldn't get there, in my personal opinion. Others may disagree. Economic development is you had to have that secure area. But Canada's approach is they hire third parties. So they'll hire NGOs, non-government organizations, to run the project. But, and quite often those non-government organizations will be from the country. So they're working on this project out in the middle of nowhere, and the economic development people or the NGO can't get there safely. So they either need to get the military to escort them out there, which is risky, very, very risky. Also, it sends a horrible message to the local population that, hey, you're trying to help us, but you're bringing guns with you. What's up? So they tried, you know, sending, they would, if we had spare unmanned aerial vehicle time, then we would run the aerial vehicle, UAV, over the area where the development was supposed to occur to see what was going on. Because quite often, you know, what you don't inspect, don't expect. So we're always frustrated by that. But I go back to, I personally believe it was right to destroy, or wrong, defeat the Taliban regime after 9/11, because Canadian troops that deployed and to hunt down Al-Qaeda, they found physical biological laboratories. They found chemistry laboratories. I mean, it was just going to get worse if we didn't do something. But we felt we had a moral obligation to try and rebuild that country, that we were not happy about bombing Kandahar City into the Stone Age with airstrikes and all that sort of stuff. So we felt that we should at least try and rebuild this country. And so, yeah, I think it was all worth it. I don't think morally we had a choice. Morally, I just couldn't see going in and eradicating the government because it was Taliban and they had helped Al-Qaeda and then leaving. It just, that's not us. And so, yeah, it was the right thing to do, even though it didn't work out. And on my tour, we were starting to go, I don't know, because we would get some headway, and then the local governor would just pull the rug out from underneath our feet. We were betrayed by local government and national government so many times that we were starting to get a sense that, yeah, we can build industry, we can build up the Afghan National Army so that they can protect their own country, but not if we don't fix this governance piece. Did that satisfy you? Like, is that a reasonable answer? Because it's a hell of a good question.
Do you ever become numb to violence when you're constantly exposed to it?
Did I ever become what to violence?
Do you become numb to violence?
No. And violence comes in many forms in the technological age. Did I ever kill somebody by pulling the trigger? No. Did I ever kill somebody by giving the order to launch a missile? Yes. A number of times, and I knew the consequences every time. We have very, very strict legal and operational and intelligence protocols to go through, and we consider the effects of collateral damage. All I have to say is you, I personally always remember that this was about people. Now, the person that we were killing was a very, very, on a number of occasions, a very, very bad people who had killed a lot of us and a lot of innocents. Like anyone that would strap a six-year-old boy with a bomb and have him go over and talk to a group of Canadian soldiers just so you could detonate that boy when he was amongst the soldiers, I have no qualms about removing them from the planet. But I never met anyone, it's not to say they weren't there, but I never met anyone that became just cold-hearted about the whole thing. It was so about people.
how did the Canadian Army prepare in order to withdraw from Afghanistan, and how did that differ from the U.S. withdrawal?
Well, the big difference was we had the privilege of having the U.S. and our other international coalition friends of holding the fort. So for us, it was just a logistical withdrawal.
Is this back 10 years ago? Or
yeah, it's about 10 years ago, yeah. The U.S. didn't have that privilege. And also, we sent special forces, it's no secret. Just recently, we sent special forces when the Americans were pulling out to try and get our interpreters and the Canadian nationals and stuff, get them into the chain. So when it came to the big military pullout about 10 years ago, I forget what year it was now, that was all very, very well planned with our allies. The other nations took over our operational responsibilities, and then we spent about 4 months just removing all our equipment and shipping it back to Canada. That was easy. Getting what the Americans faced, and it wasn't just the Americans trying to pull people out real fast. That was, I'm really glad I wasn't in uniform and stuck at National Defense Headquarters out of the plane now. That would have been tough work. And being sent forward, I wouldn't have been real keen, but you know, I would do it. But the Special Forces guys that had to go forward, would have been a very, very unstable time.
Do you think that Canada has a moral obligation to aid as many refugees trying to leave the country as they can?
Yeah, I do. And Canada is desperately short in population now, even though we've been growing steadily. So from a Canadian national point of view, we need more immigrants, a lot more immigrants. During the Syrian war, we took in, within the space of 3 months, we brought in 25,000 Syrian refugees and settled them across Canada. We brought in a lot more since then. So I'm saying absolutely, with the caveat that we screen individuals. So in the case of Syrians, we're working on this when I was here in Mexico. My deputy had to go to Jordan to help out that embassy. So I know quite a bit about this. Our screening for the refugee camps in Jordan, where a lot of the Syrians were, was we would not take single young males because of the risk associated with them. We would take males with families. Top priority went to families with no husbands because they've been killed or lost, and homosexuals were top priority because, you know, that part of the world is a little bit much less accepted. But that was the screening process. Now, when we said no single males, if they were males as part of the family unit, then absolutely we brought them over. So it has worked very well for us. The Syrians are being well integrated in the Canadian society. We're richer for it. So yes, I believe we should be bringing Afghans. But I mean, you've got to exercise due diligence too.
How did your relationship with local people work? Did it progress, or are you knowing that they turn your back? They're backing you, like as you said.
Yeah.
Going to tell them.
Yeah, Afghanistan was tough that way because, unlike other missions I've been involved with, like Bosnia, I sat down with the locals and talked to them all the time. Serbs, Bosniaks, which is a name for Muslim Bosnians, and ethnic Croats. It was really easy to get out and about and talk to these people. In Afghanistan, you go up with your interpreter and you could talk to the local farmer. Yeah, we did that. I got a poster a friend did. And then he gave it to me, mom. So it's downstairs in my bar, in my cantina, I call it, because I had the bar made in Mexico. It shows me in what is called a shura, which is a meeting with village elders. And so we're all sitting on the ground, and, you know, they're in their traditional dress, and I'm in what we call our battle rattle. I've got my full metal jacket, and you can see in the background, I've got my armed guards because I'd be a fool not to have that. And then we have the local army commander, brigade commander. And then it's all the elders of the village. My whole point out of this is that people comment on this picture, and they go, wow, that must have been an incredible experience. And I go, yeah, it was. This village there had been a lot of improvised explosive devices being planted, and it had accounted for a lot of Canadian killed and wounded. And we knew it was originating out of this village, that the villagers were just allowing the Taliban to come in. So we were there to sit to talk to them. And what can we do to change the situation? But two of the people, I knew they were Taliban. We knew that before we went into the show. We knew they were Taliban. We knew they were Taliban because the Afghan National Army Commander told us so, and our intelligence guys told us. He said, that guy there, he's Taliban. So, yeah, you can go out and talk to them with an interpreter. You can't stay. That was our biggest problem. We had to go into our various forts at night because to live out with the Afghans themselves is just inviting disaster. It just was never secure enough. But talking to the local population is critical. If you don't understand the people you're trying to help, then you can't help them, right? And so that's where we were just so doomed. Doomed is a bit strong, but we had hoped where we could eventually get to that ink spot where soldiers could go out and talk with the locals and without having to have guns.
I was really wondering about like this whole like dynamic between like the tribes, the government, and you guys. Like when you wanted to get something done, like say in Kandahar, who would you go to? Like would it be like the governor of the province, or would you have to go directly to the tribes, or how would that work?
Yeah, that's a great question. That dynamic is very, very important. First of all, you are there to help the legitimate government. So everything you do has to be done through the government. You cannot operate independently of the government, otherwise you lose legitimacy. But that does not preclude you from getting to know the tribal elders and meeting with them regularly, understanding what their concerns are, helping them, and also you get a feel for which way the wind is blowing with them. And also knowing the tribal dynamic, and because some tribes did not like other tribes, and then the ethnic splits, Pashtun versus Hazara, all of those things. So you work through the governor. However, the governor of Kandahar province was a political appointment from the democratically elected president, Ahmad Wali Karzai. President Karzai. He appointed a former general as the governor of Kandahar. He was great. He was a very religious man. He got out with the tribal elders, where his predecessor wore a business suit and just had no time for them. He respected the traditions, and he was getting a lot of ground. The problem was, the president's half-brother, Ahmad Wali Karzai, was in Kandahar, and he was pulling the strings behind the scenes. And we suspect, plus he was dirty, he was involved with drugs, he was, you name it, if it was illicit, he was involved with it, we knew it. But you can't touch Ahmad Wali Karzai because he's the half-brother of the president, and you're working with the governor, but one day the governor had a argument with Ahmad Wali Karzai, and the next day, without warning to us, not only was that governor removed, but then they went and brought in a Canadian, Afghan-Canadian, who was an academic at the University of British Columbia, and put him in as governor. And that was without consulting Canada, so it's a two-way street. So anyways, a little war story for you, but you've got to work with the local government because that is your legitimacy for being there in the first place, that and international agreements. You've got to work with them, but you also have to work with the informal leadership, whether that be tribal in the case of Afghanistan, or in Bosnia, that be local political players, ethnic political players. You got to deal with them all. And all of those sides, too, could be stabbing you in the back. So you got to be watching for that.
Well, Jamie, thank you so much. And
you're most welcome.
We're so happy to have you here, and we can't wait for you to come back again, because for sure we're going to have you back here. Hopefully we won't be wearing masks.